The Free Library of Philadelphia is proud to present a podcast from our award-winning author events series, recorded live at the Parkway Central Library on the Benjamin Franklin Parkway. To learn more about the Free Library, our unique and inspiring collections, and how your contribution can help our programs and services for the community, please visit freelibrary.org.
My name is Bud Newman. I'm on the board. And we certainly are most appreciative of your attendance tonight in recognizing Simon Sciama and his wonderful achievements. If you value this vital, life-changing institution as much as I do, please consider making a gift of support to the Free Library Foundation. The foundation helps make possible many of the library's incredible programs, like the award-winning author event series. Visit freelibrary.org support to make your gift today. It's now my pleasure to introduce tonight's author, Simon Sciama. Let me just say very briefly, he is a Renaissance man in every sense of the word. He's a genius of storytelling, according to the Times of London. He's the author of many books, including The Embarrassment of Riches and National Books Critics Circle Award winner Rough Crossings, as well as a professor of art history and history at Columbia University. A cultural essayist for The New Yorker, Sciama has written and presented more than 30 documentaries for the BBC and PBS, including A History of Britain, The Power of Art, The American Future, and now The Story of the Jews, a tie-in to the eponymous TV series. His new beautifully illustrated book spans time and continents, from the ancient bazaars of Cairo to Muslim Spain and all worlds in between. The Story of the Jews is exemplary popular history, according to the New York Times. It's engaged, literate, alert to recent scholarship, and winningly personal. Ladies and gentlemen, please join me in welcoming the wonderful Simon Sciama back to the Free Library.
Thank you. Thanks. Settle down, class. There will, as usual, be an exam later on, so pay attention, don't want to hear any snoring. Thank you so much, Free Library. I should say thank you to PBS as well for allowing us to make a wonderful co-production with the BBC. It's always really wonderful to come back to Philadelphia. It reminds me that actually, I think this is right. Goodness, historians ought to get their dates right. But in 1790, it must be the case that Washington was still living in Philadelphia. American historians, is that right? Yeah. Yes, yes. And when he goes on tour with Thomas Jefferson to promote the Bill of Rights to the constitutional amendments, as well as becoming more acquainted with the country, as he charmingly put it, the two famously founding fathers not getting on terribly well. And they visit Newport, Rhode Island, as you know. How's it, you getting the, this sounds to me like, you know, I sound to myself like a kind of cross between a very stuffy professor and Keith Richards, actually. So I could do it in his voice, if you like, you know, as well. And they go to Newport, Rhode Island in the blazing August of 1790. And famously, they have a wonderful visit, and a great letter has been written to them by Moses Satius, the leader of the Touro Synagogue, the Sephardi Synagogue there, which is really a beautiful place if you've never been there, Jewish or not Jewish. And it has inside the Aron HaKodesh, inside the Ark, this extraordinary Sefer Torah made of deerskin, which sounds very American, but actually seems to have been brought. And there's this extraordinary, beautiful, rubicund, tawny color said to have been brought, and probably was, from by a Marano family from some unidentified place in Jewish Spain after the expulsion in 1492. So Washington goes, and Seychelles has written this charming letter in which he... it's a sort of hymn, too. He really wants absolutely equal rights for the Jews, and they de facto, but not de jure yet, have equal rights, but they, of course, Jews can vote. And Seychelles presents this kind of rhetorical nosegay to Washington, that we live in an empire of laws and so on. And it's very, very touching. And the famous phrase, to persecution, I always get this wrong, to persecution, no sanction, to bigotry, no assistance, or it might be the other way around. And it's, we have now a country where every man can live beneath his vine and fig and so on. It's from quote from the Bible. And Washington writes back, it's a wonderful use of political recycling, deeply American, even from the beginning, where Washington says, it's a wonderful truth that now, you know, we live in a country to which persecution gets no sanction and bigotry, no assistance, as if he's just made it up, you know, actually. So, it's the first presidential, but not the last, plagiarism there. But it's an adorable loving. And Jefferson ditto. But Jefferson, probably more than George Washington at that point, would have been aware of a remarkable tradition, which is sort of kind of behind, in a way, much of what I wanted to do with the series and the two volumes, the second of which is being written as we speak. In fact, I think I'm going to go and finish a chapter. No, not really. And called the Hebrew Republic, and some of you may know about this. And it was literally the Respublica Hebraeorum was first written about in Italy in the second half of the 16th century by Catholic Italian Christian, obviously Catholic Christian critics of the sort of fierce counter-reformation papal line coming down from Rome. So this was very popular in cities like the Hebrew Republic idea, very popular in cities like Bologna and, of course, in Venice. There's a wonderful man called Ulisse Aldrovandi, who I've not written a lot about and who's not in the series, who believed charmingly... he was the first Gentile, I think, to echo some of the more implausible bits of bragging Jewish writers like Philo of Alexandria, for example, are committed in late antiquity, which assumed that all of Greek culture, including Plato, Aristotle, and the whole sense in which the Greeks gave the world a set of ethical norms to live by, could only have been accomplished if they'd read the Torah and the Jewish Bible. And essentially the Greeks, it's a wonderful refutation of the notion that Greeks and Jews were oil and water and were never compatible. So Aldrovandi indeed thought that pretty much everything worthwhile in civilization owed to a Jewish origin, and others followed. And what they loved about the Hebrew Republic, by which they meant, they thought of Moses as they said, a civil magistrate, it's charming, or a lawgiver. And what they noticed about the initial governance, as they thought of it, of the tribes of Israel wandering in the desert, was that there was no king. Of course, there were Jewish kings who would come along, but for these champions of the idea that a Hebrew Republic was given to the world by two figures, a civil magistrate and a chief authority, namely God himself. When you got a king, Saul, David, Solomon, you were already in deep moral trouble. David, magnificent as he was, famous for certain kind of peccadilloes, Solomon, the sort of the temple, but in other ways the beginning of the end, and so on. So they were interested in thinking about really this primordial constitution of, they thought of, they described the Sanhedrin in very wishful thinking terms as a kind of senate. There's a lovely book by the Harvard political theorist Eric Nelson called The Hebrew Republic, for those learned, many learned among you who want to follow this up. So the tradition by which there was some sort of civil governance, which began at Mount Sinai and then provided a non-royal model and non-papal model for the rest of the world, has an extraordinary kind of life Some of its early writings go out of Italy, they go to the Netherlands, they're quickly translated into English in particular, and also into French. They influence Oliver Cromwell, they influence Oliver Cromwell's secretary, John Milton. They therefore are transmitted to John Locke, and Locke and James Harrington, you'll know, are the hardcore theorists of morally righteous republicanism, in which Thomas Jefferson, that is, who was an assiduous borrower of books from the Williamsburg Library. There was a great library, in, as well as Franklin's Library, in Williamsburg, Virginia, as I'm sure you know. Jefferson undoubtedly noted. And it's an instance, really, of, as I say, something I've tried to do. The point of this whole project was really to offer a view, which was not just, sentimental cultural pluralism on my part, but I am a sentimental cultural pluralist, so sue me. But actually empirically, historically true. That's to say, Jews have never lived a separate life, even Orthodox, very Orthodox Jews, unless they've been forced to, from the cultures in which they've embedded by the likes of the Nazis. Even the Venice Ghetto, of course, was locked at night, but it was an entirely porous place. People came and went during the day. Artisans came into work in the textile shops and the metallurgical shops in the ghetto, and Jews went out of the ghetto. What a surprise. As doctors, you all know, you know the joke about President Goldblatt, don't you? Come on. Oh, you're in trouble now. Okay, so we've got an African-American president. We're going to get a woman president, for sure. So it's time for President Goldblatt. So he phones up and says, "Mom, you're coming to the inauguration." She goes, "That's a long way. I've got nothing to wear." Says, "Mom, it's Jewish president." "I'm kidding." Said, "Neiman Sachs, you know, Neiman Marcus, Saks Fifth Avenue, whatever, is open to you. Air Force One will be sent." She says, "All right." So she goes, she's sitting there in front of the Capitol steps, and President Goldblatt's taking the inaugural oath just on the Chumash, on the Torah, the first five books of Moses, and she makes with the, you know, that, oh God, I know you think really the Israeli Defense Forces would conquer wherever they went if they used the Jewish elbow, you know, it's the Jewish finger and the Jewish elbow. So she does the Jewish elbow, and she says, see that man, and neighbor goes, yes. She said, "His brother is a doctor." No, she's. So, okay, digression, surely not. Those of you who really lead a kind of pitifully enclosed life and have nothing left to do could check it out, Simon Sharmatel's Jewish Jokes on YouTube. And this was something I was originally supposed to be giving a talk on Jewish humor to the Chicago Festival of the Humanities some years ago, and I made the mistake of going to read Sigmund Freud's Jokes and Their Relationship to the Unconscious. Yeah, you've got it. One of the least funny books ever written. Turns out our jokes are all about the sudden liberation of things we've repressed. Gee. And so I thought I would do this, but I couldn't quite turn it down. So, and I thought, well, I don't want to do this, but, you know, I do know a lot of jokes. So I phone up lovely Lawrence Weschler, who I did some of the jokes with, who runs the thing, and I don't say who it is, and I say, "So, you know, a chassid and a parrot come into a bar, and the bartender says, 'Where'd you get that?' And the parrot says, 'Brooklyn, there are thousands of them, you know, so." Could go on, you know. So Sammy comes home at night, and his wife is crying her eyes out. This is a little filthy, but only a little filthy. It's Philadelphia, after all. And she's crying her eyes out, and Sammy says, "What's the matter?" He says, "Oh, you've been stopping the secretary." And he says, "Well, it's true. But she said, "We have a wonderful life, you know, in the bedroom as well." And he says, "I know." He said, "But I like you. You want to know the truth?" He said, "I wouldn't do these shocking, these shanda things if you just do one thing." She said, "What can I do?" He said, "Just moan a little." She said, "Okay, I'll do." So they go out to bed that night, as was their wont. And she said, "Shall I moan?" She said, "No, not yet." So he gets into bed, and he says, "Okay, moan now." She said, "Oh, what a morning I've had. First the plumber didn't come, the electrician didn't come. What we do." find it very difficult to get back to, we're all having such a good time. But back to work. So there is this tradition, really, of, you know, Jews and not Jews getting together. And the reason I did the series was because I think, you know, it came out of a BBC moment. And this, you know, I wrote a book about Jewish history in the Rothschilds many, many years ago, and I ran a seminar in post-biblical history in a kind of amateurish way. This is not my main field, but I always try to keep up with the brilliant scholarship. This book and the series could not have been done without the extraordinary resurgence of phenomenal scholarship in all, from archaeology through the science of inscriptions, epigraphy, it's called. If you think it sounds dry as dust, it's absolutely intellectually in every other way dazzling. I'll come on to it in a minute. Jewish art history used to be an oxymoron, no longer. The whole world of images is not only not banned by the Second Commandment. If somebody from the religious community tells you we don't do images in Judaism, they're historically profoundly wrong. The first half millennium of the existence of the synagogue, as we pointed out in the second program, synagogues are drenched in images, not just these spectacular mosaic floors, which exist in at least 40 synagogues that we know from North Africa right through the Middle East into Persia, but also, you know, there's an extraordinary synagogue in Syria. I wish we had been able to film there, but it was in Syria. And I was willing to go. BBC wouldn't let me. I'm famous for the occasional mishap while filming. It makes such a fuss. Okay, so our helicopter dropped out of the sky on fire once. Picky, you know, But they wouldn't let me go to Syria. And there in Syria, in the Damascus Museum, well looked after, are these incredible wall paintings from the synagogue at Deir Europos, a 3rd century synagogue, where there are 40 or 50 wall paintings of Moses and Samuel and David. And it's an extraordinary, it's the only archaeological trove of actual paintings. But it's quite clear that for the first half millennium of the existence of the synagogue, the Second Commandment was interpreted as a ban on sculpture, on idolatry, after all, on three-dimensional idolatrous images, not on painted images, not even of painted images of the human form. Tzipori, where we filmed, you'll have seen, is full of images of, you know, the calendar girls, as I call them, slightly irreverently, these heavily blinged up women dressed in the styles of late antiquity, representing the seasons and the months. So, you know, all these things really I wanted to bring to the story. But my main concern, well, I was astonished that the BBC asked me to do it. In fact, lovely Anshul Pfeffer for Haaretz said, when he reviewed the television series, he said Simon Sharma's done an unforgivable thing for Israel. He's deprived it of the complaint that the BBC is anti-Semitic. And I was very happy that the BBC was so enthusiastic and, you know, as the BBC does, no editorial leaning one way or the other at all. But, you know, my fellow co-religionists in Britain, there are just 250,000 of us. It's a very small community. And I was very conscious that the route into Jewish history for most people, that's true in the United States too as well, I think, is essentially the great, difficult, contentious issues of the Holocaust. Well, the Holocaust is not contentious, but what does it command? It commands either, you know, for a tiny minority of lunatics and monsters, denial, or it commands reverence. It's not a commandment, really, to engage with anything but a bowed head and a properly heavy sense of sorrow. In the Middle Eastern, the Israeli-Palestinian conflict, of course, you know, exercises, especially in Europe, profound, trenchant, and wild polemical passions. Either way, I wanted not to avoid these issues or be furtive about it. At one point in Program 3, which airs next Tuesday, I actually say, in the context of Theodor Herzl's writing the Judenstaat in 1897, the Congress in 1896, 97, I say, I am a Zionist. And this is such a kind of shocking thing to say in Britain that one of the commentators on the programs, who was very well disposed towards them, said, well, it was amazing to hear Simon Sharma saying that. It was rather like he faced the camera and said, I am a paedophile or something. It was so, not that he meant Zionism was like being a paedophile, but he said it was sort of an extraordinary admission. And my aim was to recover the term, of course, actually, stop being skulking around, being furtive. Anyone who knows what I feel, I'm not an uncritical. I love and support uncompromisingly what Israel is. I don't always love and support everything that Israel or Israeli governments necessarily do, but most of my wonderful Israeli, many of my Israeli friends feel the same way. First, you show your loyalty, and that entitles you somewhat to a legitimate stance of criticizing this or the other policy, at least so I believe. Anyway, I wanted to say, look, the story is bigger than that, and above all, Jewish history is your history too, because Jews have never been separate. Pretty much at any time you can think of. They've not been separate in the way they look. Jews in the period of the Hellenistic period wore Greek dress. They spoke Greek. They wrote Greek philosophy. They tried to bring together the Jewish tradition with the Greek tradition. It wasn't all about, you know, what we were taught as children about Hanukkah. And there was another sense, I think, actually, that's really important. It's sometimes exaggerated in the United States, but it's because it's exaggerated doesn't necessarily mean that the core of this worry is not, in some deep sense, true. That's to say, anti-Zionist polemics leaking into really ripe, old, disgusting anti-Semitism, and polemics against Israel attaching themselves, not just thinking of cartoons which could have appeared in Der Stürmer appearing in some of the Arab press, but also, you know, the sense in which Israel is protected because it's allegedly in control of the media and newspapers and the banks and Hollywood and everything else. All this kind of really old, monstrous, preposterous, demonological madness. And that is becoming more of a problem. There are anti-Semitic parties in Hungary and so on. You all know about that. Don't think it's quite... We are not in Weimar in 1932. We are really not, believe me. Even in France, Dieudonné as well. God, you know what I mind most about Dieudonné? You know, Mbala, the French comedian who's clearly anti-Semitic and who does his famous canal. I like cooking canal. Actually, I can't do this anymore. How many cooks here? Canal essentially is the haute cuisine of gefilte fish, really. It's sort of basically fancy gefilte... It's poached pike dumplings is what it is. And I can't do it because, you know... He's taken my taste away, really, for which I will never forgive him, you know. So I wanted to do this, and there is the sense also that if you're, you know, if you're Jewish and you're a historian, you don't have to end up doing Jewish history. Of course you don't, but I it took me back while I was writing, and particularly when I finished the first volume, and I was thinking about being a little Jew and reading the Bible as a historical text as a kid. And I remember actually one, if you think, let me take you back to an afternoon in 1951 when I was walking with my lovely dad past a railway station on the Thames Estuary in Essex. And against the wall, you could see the kind of ghostly letters in white paint, much faded, just two big initials, PJ. And I said, Dad, what's that? And he said, it's nothing, son. And my dad would usually over-explain, not under-explain. And so we went back home and I said, what was that PJ, Dad? And he said, it stands for Perish Judah. It's a very archaic form. And it was put there, it was a daubed slogan put there by Oswald Moses, blackshirt fascists who got outside of London and, you know, it hadn't quite somehow managed to vanish. And it made me think really very early on that there are two kinds of histories that have been really beaten about during the war, Jewish history and British history, but both had not been out for the count. And somehow they were in a weird way connected. And I remember on my dad's bookshelf, Chaim Weizmann's Trial and Error stood there side by side with Churchill's History of the English-Speaking Peoples. And then it occurred to me as I grew up that Churchill was, to some extent at least, a Zionist, partly Also, as because he felt himself so kind of engaged in some sense with the intense and almost romantic historicity of the Jewish tradition. And the British history and Jewish history were an example, it seemed to me, and it's never ceased to feel that way, of histories which are not just strolls down memory lane. I don't have too many problems with kind of costume history, although, you know, we had 4 million people thereabouts watch the first films in a series in Britain, and then we were shown at the same time as Downton Abbey. So I'm known in these because I complain so much as the Downton Rabbi, as the rabbi. Which is, but escapism is fine. It's always been there. It's okay. But history is ultimately not about mere romantic, ornamental escapism, the look of a good frock. Nor should it be. Simply a form of consolatory self-congratulation. You know, once upon a time, our founding fathers were all white, tall, brilliant, and so on, virtuous. It's not a form of totalitarian. I mean, we're not a totalitarian country, thank God, but it's classically, you know, Chinese history about, you know, essentially rules out the sense of a critical heritage. History, the nobility of history, its moral grandeur and decency and strength in the Western tradition started with Herodotus and Thucydides. Herodotus, who uses the word historia, both in a sense of a forensic analytical inquiry and a sense of storytelling, Herodotus's mission in that first great paragraph is to rescue from the oblivion of time the deeds of the Greeks and the Persians. But Thucydides is a tougher nut. He was a fired general and, you know, the whole of the great masterpiece that's the Peloponnesian Wars is structured to move towards this catastrophic moment of hubris where the overreach of Athenian power comes a cropper, as we say in Britain, in the expedition to Syracuse. So the Thucydidean tradition of history, the grandeur, the moral grandeur, is that it should keep you awake at night. Good history is a gadfly to the powerful. It's meant not to make you feel a kind of cuddly glow of pride in who you are. It doesn't have to do that, even Jewish history. But it's meant to make you ask hard questions about your shared identity and your past as well. And, you know, Jewish history, the Bible itself is an extraordinary, you know, Job talks back with understandable bafflement and indignation to God, and Jonah and Moses kvetch about being chosen, and so on. So this sense, and the Talmud is the great example of, you know, Jews, as I always say, communicate by mutually agreed interruption, and that's what happens on a single page of the Talmud. Somebody from, as my lovely friend Leon Wieseltier said in the program, a rabbi from 11th century Tunisia is arguing with Rashi, or a rabbi from 12th century Troyes, and so it goes on. So the sense of perpetual contentiousness and endless argument is also a wonderful part of the Jewish tradition. So what I wanted to do with the project, really, were these things. To say that, you know, because I reflected as a child that there, but for the force of Churchill's history, my immediate family would have been destroyed, as many of my mother's family, the Naumanns, my mother's family, were indeed destroyed in Vienna, in Mauthausen. And that history has something for the Jews. It can't, of course, actually stop the annihilation of individual or masses of bodies, but the Jewish tradition is about the protection and the conservation of our tradition, of actually what gives us our identity. And that's the really the most, you know, that is what's so powerful about. So the Jewish story is really causally related to survival and endurance. And Jews have not, I think, actually, in the sense in which they've experienced what turns out to be one of the world's most difficult issues, how do peoples of different beliefs share the same living space. We've not been unique. Armenians and Gypsies and, you know, you take your pick of those who've suffered similar atrocities and miseries. But we have been unique, I think, actually, in that we didn't, you know, whether inadvertently or not, the portable word, the word that could be written in the scroll of the Torah, could be wrapped up and moved along with us, as it was into Babylonia and to many other places in exile. And that, indeed, would endure. And I'll finish a bit later on with one wonderfully moving modern story, a story from the Second World War, where that happened. So that's what I wanted to do. I wanted to tell a richer, more complicated, more, you know, inclusive story. And I also wanted somehow to present Jewish history as more than simply an endlessly repeated cycle of calamities. Those of you who saw the medieval, yeah, exactly, a tsuris writ large. It would be absurdly counterintuitive to say that we've not had, you know, we've not had to deal with repeated suffering. It's quite true in the whole Kiddush Hashem, the sanctification of the name, the kind of suicidal martyrology is a reality in Jewish history. But then, so those of you who saw the medieval film will see that I started with this blazingly spectacular Bible, but we saw another beautiful illuminated Masoretic Bible in the collection here in the library just before dinner. It was great. That was produced in Lisbon in 1496. Great, magnificent sort of moment, biblical epiphany almost for me. But in the beginning of that medieval film, I wanted to show this great Bible that was produced in Coruña in northwest Spain in 1476, just 16 years before the expulsion from Spain, with no sense that really doom was just around the corner. I know we are a suitcase-ready religion and people, but we, as I say in the book, we prepare for the worst without assuming it will happen. We are one of the least fatalistic peoples, I believe, actually, that there's ever been. So I wanted to really alternate a true sense of tragic experience and flip it as well, so that you know, what happens, especially in a country like the United States, where catastrophe, you know, God willing, has not happened. When you flip it, even in moments of disaster and calamity, what appears to be is an extraordinary kind of tenacious grip on the vitality of life, an amazing sense of creative cultural regeneration. You sometimes see it even in the worst places, in Theresienstadt, for example. So let's roll, Paul, right, the first clip in which this issue of the balance of disaster and beauty I tried to set out. It's from the beginning of the fourth film, which you'll, I hope, see next Tuesday. At first, it seemed like a place of utter desolation. But then I saw them, the stylized angel's wings hovering over the ceiling. Out of the dust burst the colors, the blues of heaven, the reds of the kings of Judah, the rainbows coming through the glass. And then, amidst all this absence, I began to sense the presence, the cantor's chant, the murmuring banter. And there in the galleries were the women of Jewish Košice, and down below the men in silks and hats. In the spring of 1944, 15,700 Jews from Košice, the entire community, were sent to their deaths in Auschwitz. But this wasn't a place that sat passively waiting for its death sentence. Before the Holocaust, Košice, like thousands of Jewish towns and villages strung across Central and Eastern Europe, was alive, thriving, confident, noisy. The opera and the klezmer, the schnorrer beggars and the prosperous merchants, the pushcart peddlers and the street corner revolutionaries. That this world somehow flourished despite all the pounding storms that would come its way is an escape act so epic that it counts as one of history's all-time redeeming miracles. Even when systematic annihilation overwhelmed the people
the world that had nourished them survived. This is the story about how this unique culture of faith and ferment, of poetry and music, of a search for deliverance from brutality and oppression, did not get pulverized by the hammer of history. It just changed its address.
Yeah, there are two things to say about that little clip at the beginning, and that maybe you can have the lights up again. Good, thank you very much. That is indeed an extraordinarily beautiful synagogue in Košice in Slovakia. Anybody from Košice family? Often when I talk about it, there are no. Okay, and there is a great industry now of restoring some of the half, you know, those few synagogues which survived the horrors of the last war. And there's a little bit maybe over aggressive restoration. Košice, as you see, is one that's not been over restored yet, and it is extraordinarily beautiful. But the glass, of course, you'll notice, looks extremely simple, but actually the glass was part of the Bohemian, Moravian, Slovakian kind of modernist glass movement. It was a synagogue built right at the turn of the 19th, 20th century. And it was, I thought, and it, so it turned out to be the case, that even though this is an Orthodox synagogue, it was very much built as a collaboration between Jews and non-Jews in the town of Košice. And that's true of many other places we went to. Some of you may remember the last scene in the medieval program, which is me walking around the Spanish-Portuguese synagogue in Venice. And that too, which I didn't have a chance to say, at least not in the in the film you saw, was built by the workshop of Baldassare Longhena in Venice. Longhena was the great Christian Baroque architect who shortly would be about to build the Church of the Salute, the greatest church commemorating Venice's eventual survival from the terrible plague of 1630-31. So the crossovers are many, as I say, without being unduly mythic and naively sentimental about it. The photographs there, the other side of the story in a way, which also are a wonderful thing, and we explore those photos in much more detail and more lengthily in that film number four. They were the product of an amazing expedition into the Jewish Ukraine in 1912-14, very early. Most of the photographs, when you think about the record of the shtetls, were taken famously by the great photographer Roman Vishniak between the wars in various parts of Poland, and some of them may have been staged, some not. But this was a so-called expedition organized by the author of the Dybbuk, who was a revolutionary, very much a secular Jew, S. Anski, but someone steeped in Yiddish and in the religious tradition. And Anski trained his nephew to be a great photographer, and he also took a primitive recording machine. And the material, the photograph, which were lost for countless decades, were discovered in the early 1990s behind someone's sofa in St. Petersburg. It's an extraordinary story. Yeah, they're now in the, if any of us ever manage to get into Russia again, go to the ethnographic museum, where they're being wonderfully looked after and catalogued, and there's a relationship between the museum and Brandeis University, and there are nearly 200 of these extraordinary photos, which are really a remarkable document of the truth of life in Volhynia and Podolia and southern Galicia in Ukraine in the period just before the First World War. So this is a case where, you know, our instinct that we somehow have the capacity and the determination to make things survive, even when we know we might not survive in bad times. And there is a wonderful story. There's a great book about it called Who Will Tell Our History? And about the historian. So I feel very bonded with this figure. Before I just show you the last clip and then ask for your questions, which I know will almost certainly take the form of speeches. right? I mean, well, there are a lot of Jews here. This is what happens. And, yeah. There was a moment in a young historian who was a student of the great Polish historian called Simon Dubnow. He was called Emanuel Ringelblum, and he found himself in the ghetto as soon as it was established in the spring, early summer of 1940. And he'd been working on building, rather like those photos, a great archive of Yiddish life and Jewish life in the shtetls in Poland. And now, as a social historian, he was a member of the Bund Party. He was neither anti-Zionist or pro-Zionist, but he was essentially a Bundist. And what he did was to work with an organization that had grown up spontaneously in the ghetto called the Alleinhilfe. In other words, you know, helping yourselves, which was a way for people under stress with limited, increasingly limited food and medicine, and that wasn't beholden to the Judenrat, who the Nazis had appointed. And the Alleinhilfe was kind of a heroic organization, and it organized apartment tenement block residents to have their own committee meetings, which of course full of argument, you know, even in extremis. But what they were, every afternoon they met to discuss terrible things, you know, how many bodies were on the street, what medicines were available, what food was available for the children. But they kept on, you know, with music and schools and this extraordinary kind of, it wasn't a cultural efflorescence, but the degree of cultural resistance to being destroyed morally and spiritually as well as physically is astonishingly heroic. But at one point, Ringelblum and his friend Emmanuel Liechtenstein know they're not going to survive, not least because they're going to be part of the rebellion in the ghetto that breaks out in April 1943. So they start to hide the records of the Alleinhilfe and the Häufen, the apartment block committees, in milk churns and bury them. And there's an incredibly moving letter written by Liechtenstein saying, if only he would bear the day, he would be alive the day when the milk churns are brought out and broken open. It's almost like the Dead Sea Scrolls, isn't it? And would these records of what actually happened in the ghetto would see the light of day. Then he knows, and these are secular Jews, remember. Could have been, and there were rabbis among them, I have to say, as well. Then he knows he would have done his duty by the commandment, Zachor, remember. We are the only religion where we are commanded, it's Pesach soon, everybody, Passover, we're commanded in Shemot, in the Bible, in the Exodus, and then again in Deuteronomy, and then again in the Haggadah, to remember as a fundamental duty of Jews to pass on the story to generations. So this is what the people in the ghetto wanted to do, and amazingly, one of them, called Hirsch Wasser, they didn't survive. You know, Ringelblum and Liechtenstein and artists and all of them perished in the flames of the ghetto uprising. And but one fellow did survive, called Hirsch Wasser, by jumping off the train that was taking him to Treblinka. And he led, in 1950, people back to the site of the buried milk churns. And they're now in the... There'll be a prize exhibit in the Great Museum on Polish Jewry that will open next year in 2015. So this instinct, really, of telling the story onwards through time remains, you know, from the Haggadah through these modern historical epics, so deeply imprinted on our cultural bloodstream. But there are moments, having said that words are our lifeblood, as you'll see in this last clip, and I'll just play this as a short clip, where words, as I say, the subtitle of the first book is Finding the Words, partly about the Bible and how it came to be, and Josephus and other texts too. And the second volume is When Words Fail, which is a little overdetermined and possibly even the fatalism which I said Jews don't necessarily have. And we spend a lot of time thinking in the programs about how we would represent the Holocaust. We didn't want to have a whole program on the Shoah. We really didn't. I mean, mostly because there are extraordinary films and documentaries, great multi-part series on Auschwitz and so on, that have been magnificent on the show. And I didn't, to seem to me, to make a whole program on the Holocaust was in a way, again, to restore the obsession, by which I mean other people's obsession with the Holocaust, and to see it, it's almost a hand of victory to the Nazis by saying this is ultimately where Jewish history ends up. I mean, I say in program 5, there are 6 million Jews in Israel now. That's 6 million defeats for the Nazis. That's the way they didn't win, in any sense, how I like to think about it. But we did think about how he would, and the Holocaust, you know, makes an impact on all the last three films, which you'll, I hope, see next week. And we decided we'd film on Yom HaShoah, the Holocaust Day in Israel. And those of you who have been there will know it's remarkable because everything stops. And I mean, everything stops exactly where it is. Cars don't park, they simply stop and you get out of the car. Every year there's an idiot who, even though a siren's blowing, doesn't notice people have stopped and goes straight into the back of. But not many do. So everything stops and it's great. You know, there's a kind of hole torn in the sky of ordinary life. Jewish existence, Jewish history is an endless dialogue between the sense of a special destiny, you know, chosen people stuff, but really the destiny of being selected to provide the world as well as ourselves with this set of ethical principles, right way to live by, and the search for an ordinary life. That's why I began my book in Elephantine in Egypt, not with Abraham, which, you know, might be a myth. I mean, after all, the Abrahamic story was written probably a thousand years after it was purported to have happened. So, you know, maybe true, maybe not, but history sure ain't. But the Elephantine Jews, slightly oblivious, these are people in search of a kind of happily banal life. They build a temple, they marry, they have property line disputes, they argue about wills and marriages and weddings, you know, as people do. So there's this, in Holocaust Day, there's this tear. I mean, in some extent, this old dialogue is the dialogue now between Tel Aviv and Jerusalem, between contemporary life and providentially appointed life. And all of us, anything, you know, the most secular Jew in Tel Aviv has something of someone who responds on Rosh Hashanah, or even if he never goes to shul, to this sense of a kind of providential destiny. And there's something in many religious Jews, many not-so-religious Jerusalem Jews, that also just wants an ordinary, peaceful life. Of course, Jews too. And on Yom HaShoah, this sort of ordinary life is, there's a hole in the sky, and into the sky comes the Death Star of the memory of the Shoah for 2 minutes. So I wanted to do, for what I wanted, believe it or not, everybody, I wanted to shut up, and I wanted to stop talking, and I wanted there to be almost no commentary, I wanted there to be no music, and we gave cameras. I also wanted, Judaism is a communal shared religion, kriya. We are not a silent religion. It was noticed very early on how much chattering and stuff goes on. But we are a religion. We make noise to signal we are alive. And from the beginning, from the time of Ezra and Nehemiah, our readings are public and communal and vocalized and out loud. And so I wanted, in a spirit of communal making a film, to give cameras to kids in film schools over Israel, which is what we did in Tel Aviv and Haifa and Be'er Sheva, and say, go to a hospital, go to a barracks, go to a school, go to a kindergarten, go to an old age home, film, please, film for me 2 minutes in real time, film a little before and a little after, and then we'll put it together. And I'm a worst critic, quite rightly, of my own work in film as well as on the written page. But I'm quite proud of this little piece, and it's what begins the fifth film, and it pretty much the rest, I think, speaks for itself. And then I'll take your speeches immediately after. Every year in the spring, a country born from the ashes of annihilation remembers a loss for which there are no words.
everybody standing by their truck or their car or in the street just knows it could have been us. It's still heartbreaking. And then life goes on.
Thank you. Let's hear from you now. Yes, there's a gentleman there, I think. Yeah. There we go. Or is it lady? Yeah, there's a gentleman. Yeah. Hi.
The recent anti-Semitic conduct in France,
right,
especially in Paris.
You thinking of Dieudonné? I mean, you're thinking about the comedians?
I'm thinking about the gentleman who was attacked at leaving synagogue.
Oh, yeah, and yeah, horrific. Yes.
Put a swastika on it.
Toulouse assassination, yeah.
Yeah, but apparently that's part of a larger pattern of anti-Semitism in France. Do you have any comment on this?
It's a monstrous, deplorable atrocity. You know, I don't quite know what I could possibly say. I mean, it's obviously a horrific nightmare. I mean, does it indicate that there are thousands of people in France who are prepared to kill children and do? No, it absolutely doesn't. There are, you know, maniacs, really. Like, there are maniacs with guns who kill people in this country for texting in movies. You know, I mean, it's true that they're not picking racial groups, but as I said earlier on, is there a problem with anti-Zionist polemics turning into anti-Semitism? Yes. I mean, it is an awful thing that French kids, and I know this, you know, can't go on the street with a yarmulke or a kippah on. I mean, that is... But that's... It's not the case in other parts of Europe. And, I mean, there is definitely a problem. It's essentially a problem because of... I know Dieudonné is not North African, but it's a problem because you have a kind of very impoverished, often less educated than one would want, North African population living in anomie and alienation and destitution in some horrible places all around France. But, you know, for saying, is France destined to be, you know, a new Third Reich if the Front National wins the election, which it probably will, the answer is definitely no. Really no. I mean, will there be horrors around Europe? Possibly, but not... You know, I always think, you know, when you're a historian, it's very important not to see a kind of template which repeats itself over and over again. There are calamities, there are atrocities, there are horrors, there are miseries, but they're horrors, miseries, atrocities, and calamities in their own particular way. So I'm not making light of the awful thing to which you've just alluded, but it's also important to always see it for what it is rather than, you know, Hitler arrives. Marine Le Pen is not an enemy of the Jews. She's a horrible, you know, I mean, I wouldn't, you know, I don't want to see a right-wing government in France, but Marine Le Pen is not, her father is an old, bloody old Vichyite, but she is not an enemy of the Jews, you know. I mean, I don't know if that's any consolation or not. Okay, next question.
In Philadelphia, if you have Comcast, we have the benefit of having France 24, 24-hour news channel,
yep,
from France, and I have not seen that. I have also seen that the coverage of the French comedian has been very negative.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. No, Dieudonné is all over the French press, and it's a, you know,
they're,
yeah,
after him for money.
Right.
They've, you know, basically...
Right. I don't want to get hung up on the French thing, but it is a problem place. There's no doubt about it. And, I mean, the attempt to... Of course, the French government behaved very well, and François Hollande and his Minister of the Interior did the... You know, it tries to ban him for hate crimes and take him off the... But that, of course, only... It's a very difficult thing. That only added to his enormous popularity. So it's a very, very tricky thing to deal with. Look, I don't think you can make hatred disappear by criminalizing it. Maybe you can't make it disappear altogether, but you can. What you have to do is, you know,
educate people. I know that sounds very high-minded and academic and ivory tower and so on, but you know, partly this kind of exercise I've been involved in is you're not directed at those who are just really stuck in loathsome hatred. You really have to, you know, you're appealing to the broad middle center to try and educate them we're not under-resourced in terms of educational programs about the Holocaust anywhere in the world anymore. And we shouldn't give up on it, of course, but, you know, all you can do is sort of tell the truth.
Simon?
I hate that. I'm going to stop in a second, Andy. Partly, this is, promises. Partly, I made this program to, change stereotypes, because they're an awful thing. So Jaime and Moshe were going past a church one Sunday. And there's a sign outside saying converts needed, $50 bonus for signing. And Jaime says, "Ooh, $50. And Moshe said, "Shonda, you can't." He said, "Well, the Maranos did it. You know, they came back and forth, Jewish, not Jewish. How bad can it be?" And Moshe says, "Well, it's still disgusting, but times are hard. You know, how about I won't tell anyone if we split it?" So, okay, so he goes off. 20 minutes later, he comes back and Moshe said, "So how was it?" And Jaime said, "Oh, it's all right." So there's a big long pause. And then Moshe says, "So, $25. And Jaime says, "That's all you Jews think about, money, money, money."
Yes, it is over. So, folks, if you'd like to get a book, you can buy one upstairs. Please join me in thanking Simon Chama. Thank you for listening to this podcast from the Free Library of Great Conversations. If you live in Philadelphia or are planning a visit and would like to attend an author event, information on the series is available at freelibrary.org/authorevents.